fucking dumber? Greetings. Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, November 30th, 2008. Got a great show for you today, but first, before we go to the show, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement. Imagine 250 people from all walks of life sitting in a room talking about the possibilities for open, fast, and affordable broadband access for every American. On December 6th, InternetForEveryone.org will hold the first in a series of town hall meetings in Los Angeles. InternetForEveryone.org is a national initiative of public interest, civic, and industry groups that are working to see that the internet continues to drive U.S. economic growth and prosperity. The group has 130 wide-ranging members, including Google, eBay, the Writers Guild, Tech Republican, the United Church of Christ, Children Now, and the National Hispanic Media Coalition. They are all working to bring a diverse group of participants to the meeting. Free Press campaign coordinator Misty Perez-Trudson is the lead organizer for the event. She said the meeting is focused not on a panel of experts presenting information and debating the issue, but on everyday people who are affected by broadband policies.
We decided to go with a town hall meeting model. It's a little different than the typical FCC hearing model in that it places the emphasis on the public and the public dialogue and public participation rather than focusing on experts or panel experts, which certainly has its benefits. But this was a way for us to really draw out the public's interest and to hear from the public.
At the meeting, several hundred participants will break into small group discussions on what the future of the internet should look like.
We have enlisted the help of about 30 to 40 trained facilitators who will come and actually guide participants through the discussion process throughout the day so that they can have these discussions at their tables, talk about central issues to access, openness, choice, and innovation, and then potential solutions for addressing any of those issues or some of the most pressing issues.
At the end of the day, 10 major themes will be chosen that best represent the top priorities of the entire group.
And then from there, we're going to roll all of this into the rest of the information we glean from other town hall meetings and essentially distill it down to a set of national priorities that we would build into a national broadband framework to present to the next administration.
InternetForEveryone.org hopes to have the meetings and the report completed by April 2009.
With today's information coming in so many combinations of text, sound, and images, media literacy is becoming more essential. Someone who is media literate can critically analyze media in its varied forms and recognize bias, spin, misinformation, and lies. The New Mexico Media Literacy Project is one of the largest and most successful media literacy organizations in the United States. Started in 1993, the project has grown to deliver media literacy education in schools and communities across the country. Andrea Quiada has been executive director since July.
We are one of the oldest media literacy projects. Our overall mission is to cultivate critical thinking and media activism in our media culture to create and build healthy and just communities.
In addition to delivering media literacy workshops, conducting teacher and community trainings, and creating multimedia resources, the project is working with local and national partners to build a media justice movement in New Mexico. For Quijada, media justice means using media as a platform to advance social justice issues.
And that often means making sure that we all have access to the production and distribution of media. That also means that social justice issues are central and are guiding how media policy is structured and put together so that those that are the most vulnerable are at the center of those conversations when that policy is getting formulated.
And it looks like Quijada and her staff will be getting a chance to put their ideas into action. State Representative Antonio Maestas is interested in increasing critical thinking skills in students, and he believes media literacy is an effective tool to accomplish that goal.
We met with him last week, and he is looking to pass a mandatory media literacy policy so that every school in the state of New Mexico would have to offer a media literacy course as an elective to their high school students. So we're looking at the possibility of making that happen. We're thinking that this year will be the preliminary year where we do the education of the legislators, and that next year we're hoping to get that passed.
For more information about the New Mexico Media Literacy Project, go to nmmlp.org. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
Greetings, Robert McChesney here, the host of Media Matters, coming to you live today, November 30th. It is my pleasure to have today as our guest Rob Weissman, the executive
if you'd like to make a call, please
director
hang
of
up and
commercial alert.
If you need help, hang
Rob,
up
are you there? Hello, Rob. Unfortunately, I am not able to get through to Rob or to my engineer desk right now, so I'm going to let them go back to music for the time being until our engineers get this straightened out. Just bear with us. We'll hopefully be back with you in a few minutes. Thank you very much.
This is Illinois Edition. On this week's program, rural Illinois during the Great Depression through story and song.
I was born long ago in 1894. I've seen many a panic, I will own. I've been hungry, I've been cold, and now I'm growing old. But the worst I've seen is 1931. Oh, those beans, bacon, and gravy, they almost drive me crazy. I eat them till I see them in my dreams, in my dreams.
The 1930s was a decade much different from the one that preceded it. The economic prosperity and optimism of the Roaring Twenties was replaced by hardship and pessimism. During the Great Depression, jobs were lost, work was hard to come by, and people struggled to survive. Chester Baher remembers growing up during the late 20s.
In the fall of 1929, I would have been, 14 years old on December the 8th of 1929. We were farmers.
Baher is now 92 years old. He's energetic, has a full head of gray hair, and tells stories as if they happened yesterday. Baher grew up in Payson, a small town southeast of Quincy. He says he remembers hearing about the stock market crash in October 1929.
That's when we heard about the Great Depression. Well, the things we heard about brought the thing to everybody's attention. People were jumping out of the windows in New York, committed suicide. It was quite a tragedy.
But Ginny Boynton says the stock market crash only had a limited impact at first.
The stock market failure didn't immediately affect the vast majority of the population. At that time, about 3%, 2 to 3% of the population actually owned stocks. It was more a psychological effect.
Boynton is the chair of Western Illinois University's history department. One of her areas of interest is the Great Depression and the music during that time.
People were watching the stock market, saw that it was plunging, that it was losing billions of dollars a day, and that had a depressing effect on the economy. People went to the bank to get their money out. These runs on the bank caused the banks to fail, which caused other people to want to get the money out of their bank, which caused more banks to fail. So you get this kind of psychological spiral downward happening.
While not everyone was affected immediately, Boynton says the Great Depression had spread throughout the country by the early 30s. This 1932 song encapsulated the experience of the unemployed man.
This is Rudy Valley again, stepping perhaps a bit out of character in singing a song from Americana, a song that has taken its audiences by storm, which may be explained by its theme, which is both poignant and different. Brother, can you spare a dime?
Boynton says the song is poignant because it was written in the first person. She says it describes how many people thought society let them down.
They used to tell me I was building a dream, and so I followed the mob. When there was earth to plow or guns to bear, I was always there, right on the job. They used to tell me I was building a dream, with peace and glory ahead. Why should I be standing in line?
It gives you a sense of the pride that people felt that they had done their part. They've contributed to building the railroad or building the skyscrapers, what have you. They've done what society expected of them.
Once I built a railroad, made it run, made it race against time. Once I built a railroad, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime? Once I built a tower to the sun, brick and rivet and lime. Once I built a tower, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime? Once in khaki suits, gee, we looked swell, full of that Yankee doodle dum. Half a million boots went slogging through hell, and I was the kid with a drum. Say, don't you remember they called me Al? It was Al all the time. Say, don't you remember I'm your pal? Buddy, can you spare a dime?
He writes about his experience in the military, about having done everything he was expected to do, and now here he is on the street begging for a dime so that he can have a cup of coffee.
One of Tweed Mummert's first memories is when he was 7 years old. He remembers seeing people beg for food.
We lived two blocks from railroad tracks, and we had hobos knock on the door for food, you know, almost daily.
Mummert is 84 years old, and he has lived in Macomb, in west central Illinois, his entire life. He says hobos would mark telephone poles with X's to denote which households were likely to give out food. His house was one with an X.
Well, we fed a lot of hobos. You know, Mother did. We'd give them sandwiches, you know, on the back porch or on the steps. And when I was a kid, we had a what we call a hobo. There was a hobo haven out west of town. Is where they camped out there. There was a lot of hobos on the trains.
Ginny Boynton says hobos became an emblem of the Great Depression. She says Harry McClintock's Big Rock Candy Mountain is an ironic depiction of the hobo experience.
One evening as the sun went down and the jungle fire was burning, down the track came a hobo hiking, and he said, "Boys, I'm not turning. I'm headed for a land that's far away beside the crystal fountains. So come with me, we'll go and see the Big Rock Candy Mountains. In the Big Rock Candy Mountains, there's a land that's fair and bright, where the handouts grow on bushes and you sleep out every night, where the boxcars all are empty and the sun shines every day, on the birds and the bees and the cigarette trees, the lemonade springs where the bluebird sings in the Big Rock Candy Mountains."
Big Rock Candy Mountain describes this sort of hobo fantasy, I guess you could say, where everything is easy and the police can't chase you and everything you want is growing on trees or flowing in the river and so forth. It gives you this kind of mirror image of what's wrong. I mean, all the problems that people who are living that kind of life, which today we would call homeless people, are dealing with. That in Big Rock Candy Mountain, all those problems have been reversed, and instead everything is wonderful.
"And the little streams of alcohol come a-trickling down the rocks. The brakemen have to tip their hats, and the railroad bulls are blind. There's a lake of stew and a whiskey, too. You can paddle all around them in a big canoe in the Big Rock Candy Mountains. In the Big Rock Candy Mountains, the jails are made of tin, and you can walk right out again as soon as you are in. There ain't no short-handled shovels, no axes, saws, or picks. I'm a-going to stay where you sleep all day, where they hung the Turk that invented work in the Big Rock Candy Mountains."
Nola Bell and her family were farmers near Macomb. They were not homeless, but she says she remembers how her lifestyle changed during the winter of 1932. She was interviewed by John Cernicke in 1973 as part of an oral history master's thesis. His interviews were recorded on cassette tapes.
"In the old houses in those days, every room, you know, had a flue, a chimney, you know, and every room had a stove. I know the year our daughter was born, we put up an extra stove, you know, to have the house extra warm. Prior to that, people burned coal a lot, coal and wood together. But I know that winter, we was right in the midst of our depression and debt. The men went to the timber. They'd get up 4 o'clock in the morning and pack their lunch and go to the timber, and they'd cut wood all day. We'd mix in just a little bit of coal. Of course, the wood was free. You see, it didn't cost us anything. That was really economizing, I guess."
Bell says conserving during the Depression was more than just finding alternative ways to heat homes. She says she had to cut corners in other places, too.
"We just didn't buy a lot of fancy clothes or anything. Of course, I did all of our own sewing and all of our own baking, and we had everything else, chickens and the eggs and the milk and the cream and the hogs and the beef, and we even butchered mutton, you know, the sheep, which is delicious, by the way."
Bell says many people don't like mutton, but she would serve it to people, not telling them what it was. She says no one seemed to mind. Dwight and Martha Dark of Macomb also noticed their lifestyle change during the 30s. They married in 1928. Dwight Dark was a baker.
"I've been a baker all my life, and wages was pretty poor here in the early 30s. I was baking cakes at that time for, I think, about $16 a week. Head baker. So that was pretty hard going in the early 30s.
Dark says that bread was a nickel a loaf, cookies were 20 cents a dozen, and pies were about a quarter. Martha Dark says in addition to eating much of the same day after day, she conserved in other ways.
I did lots of sewing. We couldn't buy much in the way of clothing. And they used to have bundles from clothing companies, I guess. And you could buy these in big bundles for 25 cents, maybe a great big bundle. And I remember I used to make my daughter's clothes, many of them, from these scraps of material.
Martha Dark says despite having to cut corners, those in rural Illinois did not face as many problems as those in cities.
I can't remember the situations being as bad around here, that is, as noticeable as maybe you would in the cities where they had the bread lines. I can't remember that we ever had anything like that around here.
Tweed Mummert also remembers conserving. He says saving a penny here and there was crucial.
In order to save money, Mother would send me to the dairy in a gallon container to get milk, just like you dip ice cream. And you got fresh milk in a container, and you carried that, and you took that home with you. And that saved money rather than having the dairy deliver milk to your household. And a lot of people did that, that wanted to save money.
We've hooverized on butter, and for milk we've only water. And I haven't seen a steak in many a day. As for pies, cakes, and jellies, we substitute sow bellies, for which we work the county road each day. Oh, those beans, bacon, and gravy, they almost drive me crazy. I eat them till I see them in my dreams.
In my dreams.
When I wake up in the morning and another day is dawning, I know I'll have another mess of beans. If there ever comes a time when I have more than a dime, they will have to put me under lock and key. For they've had me broke so long, I can only sing this song of the workers and their misery. Oh, those beans, bacon, and gravy, they almost drive me crazy. I eat them till I see them in my dreams. In my dreams, when I wake up in the morning and another day is dawning, I know I'll have another mess of beans.
History professor Ginny Boynton says Illinois was a microcosm of the Great Depression. She says rural areas provided a taste of what life was like out west, and Chicago and Peoria showed signs of the urban depression. Boynton says, like out west, the main problem for rural Illinois farmers was overproduction. During World War I and through the 20s, American farmers produced food for the entire world. But when the 30s rolled around, the United States became increasingly isolationist. That meant food sales overseas were significantly cut back. But farmers were still growing a lot of food, and because of that, food flooded the American market, demand decreased, and with it, food prices. Boynton says farmers in the Midwest suffered as a result.
For those people, that's why you have milk strikes, for example, in Iowa, where farmers are pouring their milk out on the street to protest the low prices. You have people in this region undergoing massive foreclosure problems to the extent where they are actually engaging in various kinds of civil disobedience to try to prevent the farm foreclosures that are going on.
But Boynton says farmers' problems out west were worse because of the Dust Bowl. She says unfavorable weather made it so that over-harvested land became even more unproductive. Singer Woody Guthrie in 1935 highlighted the problems facing the Dust Bowl farmer.
I'm a Dust Bowl refugee, just a Dust Bowl refugee. From that Dust Bowl to the Peach Bowl, now that peach fuzz is killing me. Cross the mountains to the sea, come the wife and kids and me. It's a hot old dusty highway for a Dust Bowl refugee.
This is Illinois Edition.
Hard, it's always been that way, here today and on our way, down that mountain, across the desert, just a Dust Bowl refugee. We are ramblers, so they say, we are only here today. Then we travel with the seasons. We're the Dust Bowl refugees. From the Southland and the Droughtland come the wife and kids and me. And this old world is a hard world for a Dust Bowl refugee. Yes, we ramble and we roam, and the highway, that's our home. It's a never-ending highway for a Dust Bowl refugee.
Throughout the 1930s, Americans suffered economically more than any other time in U.S. history. Ginny Boynton says there was no part of the country that went untouched. There was one part of the country, though, where people were hurt more than just financially. In the South, some lost their lives. Abel Meerpol was a Jewish school teacher from New York City. After seeing a photo of African Americans being lynched, he wrote the lyrics to Strange Fruit. Billie Holiday first recorded the song in 1939.
Southern trees bear a strange fruit, blood on the leaves and blood at the root. Black bodies swinging in the southern breeze. Strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees.
There was a spike in lynching during the 1930s as people look for scapegoats to blame for the difficult times they're facing. The vulnerable people in society, which in the South certainly included African Americans, were subject to increased harassment, being thrown off their land, losing their jobs, and getting lynched.
Pastoral scene of the gallant South. The bulging eyes and the twisted mouth. Scent of magnolia, sweet and then the sudden smell of burning flesh. Here is a fruit for the crows to pluck, for the rain to gather, for the wind to suck, for the sun to rot, for the tree.
Boynton says the country was ready for change. President Herbert Hoover was extremely unpopular. Hoover became synonymous for suffering. People Hooverized on butter, some used newspapers as Hoover blankets while living in their Hoovervilles. Boynton says Hoover deserves some of the blame, but not all of it.
Part of the difficulty for us today is remembering that the presidency was not then what it is now. The president did not have the same kind of influence, I guess you could say, in society.
Boynton says Hoover was previously successful. He had organized relief for starving Europeans during World War I, and he was Secretary of Commerce throughout the 20s. Boynton says Hoover's reaction to economic problems was not unusual at the time.
He comes from a tradition that believes in individual initiative and volunteerism as opposed to government action. And so he's not willing to use the resources of the federal government to provide direct assistance to the population. He doesn't even really like using it to help out cities and states. We need to remember the country had basically every 20 years or so gone through a serious contraction all through the 19th century. In the 1850s, in the 1870s, the 1890s, the Depression of the 1890s was still the second worst we've ever had in this country. So when the Depression of the 1930s began, and the only reason we didn't have one in the 1910s was because of World War I, when the 1930s Depression gets started, first it's like, okay, here's another contraction. You know, it's not a big deal. It was initially not as bad as the one in the 1890s or the post-World War I unemployment. And so there is a reluctance initially for people to accept the fact that this is an animal of a different stripe.
In 1932, the country was swept up in a presidential race. Franklin Delano Roosevelt handedly beat Hoover in a landslide victory. Happy Days Are Here Again, a song that debuted on Black Thursday in 1929, became FDR's campaign anthem. In 1933, FDR delivered one of the most famous inaugural speeches.
This is preeminently the time to speak the truth, the whole truth, frankly and boldly. Nor need we shrink from honestly facing conditions in our country today. This great nation will endure as it has endured, will revive and will prosper. So first of all, let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror, which paralyzes needed efforts to convert retreat into advance.
'92-year-old Chester Baher remembers when Roosevelt became president.
He was a big person at that time to bring us reform. One of the things that he took over was to get people to work, to have income, to have spending. He said we had to get the money in the hands of the masses to spend to create the prosperity, and that was his theory.
To get people to work, Roosevelt began New Deal programs. Some of the programs included the Works Progress Administration, National Youth Administration, and the Civilian Conservation Corps. Baher joined the CCC when he was 17.
We got on a train and took out. We went way out to Oregon. We were doing working on the foresters for roads, fire breaks, and be called out on. And when the fires would break out, we'd be called into. To help with the firefighting.
The CCC recruited a quarter of a million unemployed men. It put them to work in the country's national forests and parks. Baher says it was hard work, but he says his time with the Corps was also fun.
Well, in the CCC camps now, we would, we had little ball games and stuff. Usually something going around in the evening. Something. But then on the weekends, like Saturday morning, we would take off. And there in Oregon, we'd go into Klamath Falls. We could stay over the weekend. We could go to movie picture shows. There'd be dances. There's one very outstanding movie. That was Ginger Rogers. Oh, everybody just raved about Ginger Rogers.
Our stuff can't top this.
I guess Rogers gotten us in bad again.
It's going to be a long walk back home from here.
Just how much does it cost to get home from here?
Home nothing. I'd like to try this thing just once. Come on, honey.
We'll show them a thing or three.
Ginger Rogers and Fred Astaire danced the carioca in the 1933 film Flying Down to Rio. As a member of the CCC, Baher spent most of his time in Oregon. On the state's northern border with Washington, FDR's New Deal administration built dams and irrigation canals along the Columbia River. Woody Guthrie wrote and performed 29 Columbia River ballads.
Green Douglas firs where the water cut through. Down her wild mountains and canyons she flew. Canadian Northwest to the ocean so blue. It's roll on, Columbia, roll on. Roll on, Columbia, roll on. Roll on, Columbia, roll on. Your power is turning our darkness to dawn. So roll on, Columbia, roll on. Tom Jefferson's vision would not let him rest. An empire he saw in the Pacific Northwest, St. Louis and Clark, and they did the rest. So roll on, Columbia, roll on. Roll on, Columbia, roll on. Roll on, Columbia, roll on. Your power is turning our darkness to dawn. So roll on, Columbia, roll on.
He has a series of verses in there in which it's kind of nice because he lays out sort of the history of the region. He talks about Lewis and Clark getting over to the Pacific River, Pacific Ocean, and he lays out the geography of the region, how the Columbia River comes down out of Canada and flows to the Pacific Ocean, and talks about the role that the dams are going to play in power generation for that region and how that's going to bring new job opportunities to people, that it is a huge engineering feat. It was, at the time that the Columbia River Dam was built, it was the largest slab of concrete in the world. It's since been surpassed, but it was a huge engineering feat to get done. That it was going to bring irrigation to farmers in the region by sort of taming the river, but that it wouldn't interfere with shipping. So he talks about how the ships are still going to be, you know, in locks there. They're going to be able to continue to use the river for shipping, even though there's these dams now being built on it. And it was it's a very rollicking sort of tune, I guess. And so it's easy to listen to and sing along with.
Thing ever built by a man to run the great factories and water the land. It's roll on, Columbia, roll on. Roll on, Columbia, roll on. Roll on, Columbia, roll on. Your power is turning.
Boynton says the New Deal was working. She says it helped bring the country out of its worst economic depression. Back in Illinois and throughout the country, Americans heard President Roosevelt tell them that everything was going to be okay. Like in this fireside chat heard over the radio in 1933.
After all, there is an element in the readjustment of our financial system more important than currency, more important than gold, and that is the confidence of the people themselves.
Boynton says the Great Depression did not end until 1941. She says when Pearl Harbor was bombed, unemployment was still up around 15%. She says it was only when the U.S. began massive spending during World War II did the U.S. come out of its depression. Throughout the 1930s, people suffered in various ways. Farmers out west endured the Dust Bowl, hobos hopped trains and begged for food, and there were differences in the way people in cities and rural areas dealt with their troubles. But in Illinois, it was a bit of everything. Chester Baher says the Great Depression was not about one state suffering. He says it was about what the country went through as a whole.
The tragedy of the people suffering, I think, from the lack of any kind of income or being able to provide for their family, like living quarters and things like that, seemed to be the biggest thing that sticks in my memory in the thought of going forth, which went on for many years. I think anyone in my day, in my time, always regarded Franklin Roosevelt as one of the big men that come out that help the poor people.
This week's Illinois Edition was produced by Tri-States Public Radio in Macomb. Special thanks to Jenny Boynton, John Cernicky, Tweed Mummert, Chester Baher, and Rich Egger. Thanks also goes to Jeff Hanks, Marla Visdahl, and Kathy Nichols of Western Illinois University's Archives. I'm Alex Hoyer for IPR, Illinois Public Radio.
A winter storm warning for snow and blowing snow for Ford and Livingston counties is in effect until 6 o'clock tomorrow morning. A winter storm warning for heavy snow is in effect for McLean County until noon tomorrow. A winter weather advisory is in effect until noon tomorrow for Iroquois County. And a winter weather advisory is in effect until 6 o'clock tomorrow morning for the rest of the WILL severe weather coverage area, except for Clark and Cumberland counties. You're listening to WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana.